Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. I'm your host, Austin Peterson, and today's show, I have a special guest. His name's Mithias Holt. He's a senior fellow in Freedom to Innovate at Institute for Liberty and a contributor to the Libertarian Republic. Mithias, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Austin. It's good to be here.
Okay, so big firestorm, I guess I'll use the sweet word for it. The firestorm was started yesterday on the internet. It's just a typical Monday for Leif Beaberson, Liberty Champion. For other people, they had a bad day. In fact, there were so many panties in a twist yesterday that Victoria's Secret had to be called in for backup because I wrote an article called Five Reasons Why I'm Not an Anarchist. And I, you know what's funny, Mithias? Like, I do these listicles and people really make fun of them and they're like, this is ridiculous, ha ha ha, nobody takes you seriously, blah blah blah. But the listicle was just a simple dumbed down version of a podcast that I did last week where I explained very carefully that I was a minarchist. And I read from Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and it was very intellectual and highbrow, and almost nobody listened to it, Mithias. But then I write a dumb listicle, and all of a sudden it's a big scandal. I don't understand. Mithias, what is the deal with these anarchists? Do you think the problem is they just don't read enough about minarchy? Do they just not understand the law? Is that the problem?
I think that the problem with anarcho-capitalists, well, there's many, but to answer the question that you have, I think the trouble is that they not only have no understanding of how the law works, but have active contempt for legal thinking, which is really quite dangerous if you want to propose a system which has to have a functional substitute for one of the most important elements of society, which is a legal system. There are many different ways that law can operate across all sorts of different countries. There are many different ways that constitutions can be structured. Bills of rights can be written in, and whether those do anything is an open question. Justice Scalia certainly doesn't think so, according to a recent article at the Franklin Center. You need to be able to understand the question of how the law works, what the law does, and how lawyers, judges, and since this is sort of the same thing, because since Oliver Wendell Holmes, lawyers have been trained to think this way, how the hypothetical offender will think about the law and how someone who seeks to exploit the law and exploit what is allowed and what is not will think, which is something that a lot of anarcho-capitalists fail at doing in a really substantial and frankly troubling way.
But Mithias, here's the funny thing. That was brilliant, and I think that you've nailed it here. But I want to get back to the sort of the visceral argument here before we really dig down deep into the substantive argument. So yesterday, yeah, I wrote the article Five Reasons Why I'm Not an Anarchist, and the number one reason that I argued was because a right is a guarantee, meaning that it is something that must be provided. Now, that was the first thing that the anarchists sort of seized on. They're like, this is so stupid, I don't even have to move on. But here's the funny thing, Mithias, they didn't ask me where I got that definition of a right. Do you know where I got that definition of a right?
Go ahead and tell me.
Straight from a constitutional scholar himself, Judge Andrew Napolitano. So I actually learned my definition of a right that anarchists are deriding from the judge who said, Austin, a right is something that must be provided. You must have a right, you must have free speech, you must have freedom of press, you must have the right to be safe and secure in your person's places and effects without, papers and effects without unreasonable searches and seizures. And those are guaranteed. I think that maybe there's maybe a difference. Maybe anarchists just like to believe that people like the judge are anarchists. They like to believe that people like Ron Paul are anarchists, even though people like Ron Paul and the judge say things like we should obey the Constitution. I don't get it. Do they just mean that? Are they secret anarchists, or is it just maybe a little bit of a willingness to suspend a disbelief so that we can have heroes in our philosophy of no heroes and no leaders?
Well, I think that the main issue here is that a lot of anarchists are deeply confused about how rights work. And I know you want to keep this fairly non-weeds oriented at the moment or not get too far into the weeds, but I think there's an actual point to be made here. So I'll get a little think tanky for a second. The trouble with what you've just described is that rights are, as you say, things that have to be provided. They have to be self-executing in some way. you can make the argument that rights are not provided by the government, they're provided by God, but the question then becomes, who enforces those rights? And that seems to be where the question comes in. Now, generally speaking, if someone says, I don't even have to respond to this, it's because they're playing to the choir. But I think it's interesting, and I'm not sure if this is exactly what they were saying, but I think it's interesting that when you argue with anarchists, I actually got into a debate with one of them on that wonderful medium of reasoned arguments, Facebook, and if you can't spot the irony there. The thing is that when I got in an argument with one of them and I pointed out these arguments from the Constitution, which is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most libertarian governing documents on the face of the earth, they had complete contempt for the Constitution. They called it a magic scroll, I think was the term they used. Mm-hmm. So it may be that as far as anarcho-capitalists are concerned, the idea of rights in general is completely laughable. And in fact, if you look at their philosophy and you actually analyze how it has to work, rights are, what's the phrase, Tonstoffel? Well, I think from them it would be Tonstoffer. There right. ain't no such thing as a free right. Mm-hmm. You have to pay for everything, your rights included. And really, in a world where capitalism is the only enforcement mechanism, that would necessarily be how it has to work. So some of them may be just confused. Others may simply not believe that rights are all that important, which is really interesting from a movement that claims to be all about freedom.
Well, of course, because it's sort of like it's an abdication of responsibility. I think that the problem with anarchists is that they don't want any responsibility for any other person. But the problem is that in order for their rights to be respected, they have to respect other people's rights as well. And so when you talk about like, you know, obligations, you know, a right is absolutely an obligation because, for example, if you do believe that someone who is accused of a crime has a right to a lawyer, that's a positive right. That's a right that requires resources to be expended. And I'm not so certain that in a system of competing legal, competing legal systems, which, by the way, we already have on a grand scale, meaning that every different country in the world has a different legal system, so we do have competing legal yeah. systems. But the issue here is that I simply do not believe that a system of competing legal systems within the United States on an anarchist system is going to mean that the person who accuses me of a crime is going to say, oh, well, let me also just provide you with an impartial lawyer. You know, my ass, right?
No.
Not to make it sound too. I guess not to bring it out too much, but that's really what a big problem is I see with the anarchist legal theory.
Well, let's actually take that example for a second, and let's even drill even further down. Because you could make the argument that, well, you don't need a lawyer if there's no court. Or you don't the right to a lawyer, political philosophers really have been talking about the concept of positive versus negative rights for ages. And so a positive right is something that you have a right to, and a negative right is generally something you have a right to be free from. So right to free speech doesn't mean the government has to provide you with a megaphone. It just means you have the right to talk and you have the right to get your message out there in whatever way you like. That's a negative right. Positive right is something like a right to health care where the government has to provide you with health care, or to use an example we actually have in this country, a right to education where the government has to provide you with an education. And the right to an attorney is a positive right. So you could deny that people should have the right to an attorney and be consistent and say you only want negative rights. That's one way to do that. But the right to an attorney is distinct from the right to a judge to hear your case, which I think we don't even get that far with anarcho-capitalists. I think that at the point where people can hire their own armies, which is generally how this works, their idea is that everybody will be able to look at Blackwater and all the rest of these private contractors and hire somebody to protect your rights. At the point where you can hire an army to defend your house from theft, there is no need to have someone tried in an impartial court to adjudicate their guilt. You just send your hitman to shoot the person. And the only situation in which I can imagine there being a market for courts in this system is one where people have roughly equally sized armies, which in that situation you don't so much have a court system as you have Game of Thrones, where two people sit down and they come to a compromise, which is not even one that's rooted in any sort of sense of justice or small L liberalism. It's just rooted in, okay, we both have equal amounts of power. Let's try and stop everyone's hackles from being raised and reach a compromise. So ironically, for a system that claims to despise politics, it actually creates the most fruitful grounds for ancient politics, which was violence and the means by which to avoid violence by compromising between two equally angry and violent people. This gets to what I say in the article, which is that it essentially throws people into a Hobbesian state of nature and says, that's great. We love the bellum omnium contra omnes. We love the war of all against all, because then there's competition for who's at war. And that's
right.
Not helpful.
Right. Right, right. Well, many anarchists, of course they would deny this, but many anarchists, I think, want to bring down the system simply so that they can impose their own totalitarianism on the rest of us. And I think that does include many anarcho-capitalists who, for lots of different reasons, have their own brand of tyranny. And, you know, they would do sort of things, you know, some of them are conspiracy theorists, not all of them are. Some of them are anti-Semites, not all of them are. However, I do remember I did a thorough debunking of conspiracy theories when I was at Porkfest one year, that there had to be one of our anarchist friends had to be restrained from committing violence against me because of my free speech, which so offended him that he threw himself into a rage and had to be pulled away from me. Of course, the non-aggression principle, I guess, doesn't apply when someone disagrees with your version of anarchy. Now, I want to move on here. I want to get to your piece, Mithias, but I want to get through just like the sort of, again, the facile arguments. I want to get to the surface level arguments before we really dig into the meat here, because we're going to talk about your awesome piece that this podcast is attached to. But I want to talk about the number three bullet point on my list. I said that anarchy means the non-aggression principle is optional. Now, I pulled that directly from Robert Nozick, who said that if you actually believe in the non-aggression principle, then you're not an anarchist, because the non-aggression principle needs to be enforced, okay? If it's a principle, then that means it's optional, okay? In an anarchist state, there would be no one to enforce the non-aggression principle. It would be might makes right. Whoever has more resources makes right. And so, to me, the problem with anarchists is that they claim to believe in the non-aggression principle, but that the actual what would come out the other end is a force of coercion, and that would necessarily be the government. If you have a dispute with your neighbor who you say stole your life savings, okay, how are you going to sue them or have them arrested to get it back? I mean, assuming that you're even correct. You know, in an anarchist state, no one is responsible for defending life, liberty, or property unless they're paid to do so or unless they're doing it so for themselves. You know, breach of contracts, theft, fraud, or murder could be committed against those who do not have the means of self-defense. And I made the joke, of course, in Encapistan, no one can hear you scream and no one cares. is that accurate in your mind?
I think that the answer to that, you know, I was talking to another one of our contributors, and I won't name the person, but suffice to say that if anyone knew who this was, it would break their heart.
Oh, no.
I was talking to another one of your contributors who's very beloved by anarcho-capitalists, and this person pointed out that the non-aggression principle has to be believed by a majority of the population. In order for an anarcho-capitalist state to work, it just has to be inherently accepted. Which, if you were to indoctrinate everybody with the non-aggression principle, say by flipping a switch magically and do that, you might be able to create an anarcho-capitalist state. But then it raises an important question. Why is there a market for self-defense at all? Why is there a market for weapons? Why is there a market for anything? Unless you implicitly accept that people might be violent, and then you get to this problem that you point out, where people will actually start taking advantage of the pacifism of other people. They'll start taking advantage of other people's lack of resources in order to hurt them. A good example I could think of, actually, because no matter which side you're on, it would turn out badly in an anarcho-capitalist world. Take the Columbia rape case. Do we really want Emma Sokolowitz to be able to break into Paul Nungesser's room with an AK-47? Or, alternately, do we really want Paul Nungesser to take an AK-47 and shoot Emma Sokolowitz while she's carrying her mattress? No. But without a court system, without a means of dispute resolution that is inherently peaceful, that's precisely what would happen. Or, possibly, one of their defenders would do that. And even if you tell your defenders, please don't do this, just ask anybody in any social movement, it never happens that way. There's always some insane person who does something that makes a movement look bad. And if you said crime is legal, I mean, the Purge kind of shows you what that looks like.
I personally don't want to see a war between Anita Sarkeesian's fans and Gamergate, but that's what you'd see in this universe.
But wait a minute, wait a minute. I thought the government was the only source of evil, and that humans are naturally good, and that if we had no government, no one would hurt anyone.
Yeah, you know, if you believe that, then welcome to the camp of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and please stand over there on the left with the anarcho-syndicalists, because that's the entire basis for their philosophy. And this is really what my indictment of anarcho-capitalism is. If you have to, if you make it absolutely consistent, it has to reduce to anarcho-syndicalism, because the fact is that capitalism simply will not survive, because capitalism is an intrinsically adversarial system in the way that it works. It is inherently a competitive system. And if you believe that everybody is naturally cooperative and naturally good, then there is really no need for these really nasty and competitive urges to be given free rein. If everybody believes in the non-aggression principle, who's to say, and this is the real point, leave aside believing in the non-aggression principle for a second. Who's to say what aggression is? Who's to say that me starting a company that might put you out of business isn't aggression?
Right.
Who's
right.
to That's, say that...
That was my final point yesterday, the fifth argument with private property. Who defines what is private property? You know, in an anarchist society, there is no commonly accepted definition. You can't force your definition of private property on me. And, you know, some may argue that they have a right to food and that their neighbor's surplus should be rightly theirs, you know, since the creek from their own property maybe feeds the crops next door. The farmer next door might argue the creek belongs to him since it flows across his fields. And so there is no neutral arbiter that would step in and say, okay, well, private property rights are defined thusly. And I do believe in a total centralized monopoly on the definition of private property. Let me say that again. I believe there is only one definition of private property, and that individuals have the right to own and dispense with their own justly acquired private property. And there should be no other accepted definitions. If you believe that that someone can have a different definition of private property, well, how can you really be you can be a libertarian, I guess, but you might as well be a pacifist and an Amish, because and you better hope that the people who have a definition of private property that are different than yours aren't going to take their guns and invade your private property. Because the problem is that it's what was the argument from the founding fathers? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. And I'm sure that, of course, the anarchists have like a really snappy rebuttal to that, which it can be rebutted. But there is a good point there that were made by the framers when they discussed about what we have a government for, which is to restrain the violent passions of man. Somebody's like, "Oh, you're a cynic." I'm like, "Well, I do think that that humans tend to harm one another." Now, I want to get into the depth of your argument here, because you start out with some great quotes. The first one that really stuck out to me that was amazing, Ayn Rand. "Anarchism is the most irrational, anti-intellectual notion ever spun by the concrete-bound, context-dropping, whim-worshipping fringe of the collectivist movement where it properly belongs." What is she saying there?
I think what she's talking about is the brand of anarchism that was most prevalent in the 60s and 70s, but which is still true of anarchism today. Anarchism has historically been the provenance of the far, far, far left. In fact, you can make the case that Karl Marx's original notion of communism was essentially a post-scarcity anarchist world where there's so much abundance, there is so much stuff being produced on a regular basis that there's just no need for capitalism anymore, and everybody can be whatever they want at whatever hour of the day, and nothing needs to change. There's no compulsion required of any kind, no necessity of any kind. Certainly, there have been plenty of anarchist movements started in the United States that have been extremely far left, all of them, to a number. Robert Owen is a good example of someone I can think of who started a leftist anarchist commune. In fact, the phrase commune, which is what you find as the sort of substitute for a state in a lot of these anarchist systems, is intrinsically associated with the far left. I don't know of any capitalist communes, do you?
Good question. the United States? I mean, it's at least capitalist.
Well, that's a state, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is, yeah. Capitalist communes? No, can't really think of any.
Yeah, no, because the fact is that when you have a quote-unquote commune, what's commune a root of? Communism. Okay. You can't have a capitalist commune for the simple reason that capitalism intrinsically creates a lot of social division. It creates divisions between rich and poor. Those are not static classes, but the classes do exist either way. It creates divisions between people who run businesses and those who don't run businesses. It creates division employer-employee. It creates divisions between the employed and the unemployed. It creates divisions between those who can afford luxuries and those who can't. It creates a difference between who inhabits which market. These are not idle differences, and the amount of animosity that exists. Listen, if you get a bunch of people who are fans of, say, Britney Spears, and you put them with a bunch of people who are fans of Christian rock, you have a war on your hands. Imagine that transposed onto every consumer choice in the history of mankind, and you have an idea of the amount of social division that competing markets can create between human beings.
All right, so you have gone off on a tirade in this article that you've written. I mean, this useful idiots for social justice. Now, in this argument, in this, you talk about, you kind of compare Kathy Reisenwitz with John Stuart Mill. If people don't know who are listening, Kathy Reisenwitz is a sort of like former movement libertarian, a feminist libertarian who made a lot of waves when she argued that slut shaming was coercion. And so what you've done here is you've taken her argument there with John Stuart Mill, who says that indirect forms of persuasion like shaming or the passive power of majority opinion is coercion, meaning that like everybody disagrees with you and that's coercion. But you say that you think Reisenwitz and Mill may have a point. What do you mean?
What I mean is that let me be quite clear. I would not feel coerced by being slut shamed. And I suspect, based on what I know of Kathy, that she doesn't actually feel all that coerced, because if you feel coerced, you tend to change. But neither of us would change our behavior on the basis of being called sluts. But what I think would actually be valid to raise here is that there is no really principled distinction you can draw between certain forms of social shaming and certain forms of violence in terms of the coercive power they can have on people. I'm not sure whether Justine Sacco would rather have her purse stolen than have her job taken away because she got shamed on social media, but I would suspect she'd take the purse over what happened to her. I'm not sure that anybody who's been targeted by the rabid online outrage machine wouldn't rather just be punched in the face. But when you ask a lot of anarcho-capitalists, what counts as violence, what counts as force, what counts as coercion, you're going to get a response that is strictly, it's only aggressive physical violence. Now, that's if they're fairly doctrinaire. People like Kathy, who, by the way, I believe was an anarcho-capitalist when she was still a capitalist, she's still an anarchist. People like Kathy believe that coercion can extend to shaming. Well, all right, fine. So let's say shaming can be defined as oppression, which to some people, I grant you, it could be. Shaming people can be extremely oppressive in the right hands. And John Stuart Mill does, in fact, make that point in On Liberty. The entire book is about the power of social shaming and how dangerous it is when a majority opinion can repress unpopular viewpoints, which, funnily enough, I think Kathy could stand to learn a bit from that one when it comes to her friends in the social justice movement, but let that pass. The fact is that if you can say shaming is oppression, who's to say that just making a contrary argument is an oppression? That's what we heard from the Oberlin students when Christina Hoff Sommers went to speak. They didn't say Christina Hoff Sommers is wrong and we shouldn't have people who are wrong on campus. They said Christina Hoff Sommers is committing violence against rape victims. Violence against rape victims by making an argument, by speaking.
Right.
Now, unless you can draw a principled distinction that you can persuade wider society to accept between speaking about a subject that is controversial and punching someone in the face in terms of which one is more quote-unquote coercive, unless you can construct a principled distinction to explain why one of those is going to necessarily apply to more people, you really are going to have a problem, because the instant you start teaching the non-aggression principle, this is why a legal education would be helpful, people will start twisting the word aggression. If Bill Clinton can twist the meaning of the word is, the word aggression is a whole nother ball game.
Well, you really think anarchists would do that? Just go out there and change the definition of aggression or things like something important like that just to obscure it so that they could serve their own purposes? You really think they would do that? No. I mean, listen, Mithias, I mean, we're dealing with a, I mean, come on, we're on the fringe, you know what I mean? Like, you and I are crazy just for the fact that we want a minarchy compared to the rest of these people. You know, one of the points, the funniest points in your article here is you're like, look at the traffic numbers for Lou Rockwell and compare them with the traffic numbers for Gawker. Now, imagine every one of those unique visitors has a gun and ask for yourself which army wins. I'm sure that every, like, you know, libertarian is going to think that they're some kind of a badass that could take on the Red Army. But no, the Red Army will eventually roll over you. So, you know, so it's the problem is that with our tiny little movement that we have, there is this sort of this just absolute irrational hatred of anyone who is kill the outsider kind of a thing. We have this sort of this kind of a scapegoat thing, which to me is much more reminiscent of a cult here. You know, that we have the anarcho-capitalist cult in a sense. And that what's happening is that these people are engaging in groupthink in such a way as to make them, to me, as dangerous and unstable as the status that we oppose. But you know what else is funny too, Mithias, is when I was doing my research on minarchy and doing, you know, reading through Nozick and some of the other arguments, you know, the debate between him and Rawls.
Yeah.
But what I found was interesting was that there are more criticisms of minarchism by anarchists than there are actual texts written by minarchists themselves. Meaning that when I went to go study, like go to the Wikipedia page right now for minarchism or Night Watchman State, and it's like, you know, a basic description of what it means and then pages upon pages of criticism. I mean, it's just like this desperate, you know, panicked screeds by Rothbard and many other anarchists, who, you know, Samuel Konkin and others, who are just like, no, this is the worst thing. I think it terrifies them to see someone say, oh, no, I do understand what you mean. I just reject it. And so that the argument on their behalf just becomes, nuh-uh. I mean, if you read Rothbard's argument against minarchism, he sounds like every moron anarchist today. He literally says, I don't see how there could ever be a, quote, immaculate conception of a minarchist state. Do you realize, Rothbard, you fucking moron, that is the same argument that they use against anarchists, that you can use against anarchists, that there will never be an immaculate conception of an anarchist state either? So, I mean, I don't know what it is that these people have taken a stupid pill that they think that minarchy is somehow more dangerous than full-blown communist statism. But it seems to me as if communists and anarcho-capitalists really ought to get in bed together because they share more commonalities than they disagree.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I was at a seminar hosted by a major libertarian organization a couple years back, and someone was talking about the how wonderful it would be if you removed all of these various different regulations and all these wonderful different things on a strictly Austrian basis without any evidence for their claim. And, you know, I raised my hand and said, well, hold on. You know, I'm sympathetic, obviously. I agree that these regulations are bad. But without some sort of evidence that the world's going to be better without them, what are you going to say? And their response was, well, you know, if you strip this away, then economic growth will just make everything better. I said, okay, how do you know? And they said, well, it just follows from first principles. And the only reason we don't know is because it's never been tried. And so I raised my hand again and said, but wait, isn't that precisely what communists could say about Marxism? And to the person's credit, she said, yes, that is what they would say.
Right.
And that's exactly what I find really funny is that the minarchist position actually enables you to take a position that is way less vulnerable to criticism than the anarcho-capitalist position, because the minarchist position is the antidote to every single one of those stupid Salon articles that is like, well, you have to have a government, so libertarianism is wrong. Like, okay, fine. Yes, but saying the government should be as small as possible because of X, Y, and Z is not the same thing as saying we want no government at all. What it's saying is these functions are unnecessary. These parts are unnecessary. You don't need 20 government buildings. You need 5 or 3 or 2 or 1 government building or maybe just an office. You don't have to say we want anarchy, literally, to get. And that's what the straw man is that the Daily Show and the Salon people and Gawker and literally every hardcore statist out there uses is you just want no government at all. You just want, F you, got mine, let me shoot people from my little survivalist compound in Idaho. No, we don't. Some people do.
Right. Well, if you think that that's a straw man too, you're absolutely wrong when you talk about shooting people from the roof, because I have honestly heard anarchists say that if someone comes onto their private property, like, you know, then they have the right to murder that person. And it's like, okay, yeah, so let's say the little Girl Scout from her cookies, you know, the little Girl Scout wanders onto your lawn and gets blown up by a landmine. I guess there's just, you know, oh, well, she violated your private property, you know. And they do make these honestly ridiculous arguments. And they actually argue against the non-aggression principle, which they claim to hold so in such high regards. Of course, you know, they like to make the joke. I know you must have liked this little turnaround that I did. They say, social contracts, I didn't sign shit. And it's like, well, I flipped it around and I said, the non-aggression principle, I didn't agree to that. You know, I said, non-aggression principle, I didn't sign shit. Of course, you know, I said it to be more catchy, of course, to sound like how they sound. But the reality is that, you know, in an anarchist society, not everyone has to accept the non-aggression principle. Again, it's just a principle. So I bring it back to the rule that if you do believe in the non-aggression principle, then it should be enforced. And if it has to be enforced, whatever mechanism of enforcement will necessarily have the effect of government. Is there anything else you want to add? We're going to get a lot of hatred from this one. So let's come on. Let's go. Let's go for a goal. Let's go for a million hates on Facebook.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure we're going to get a lot of angry 30-minute YouTube responses that are literally recorded in dark rooms by someone wearing a Guy Fawkes mask. But setting that aside, I think that let me pose this question to the anarchists, and then I'll say one more thing. Who would you rather be tried by? The most statist left-wing judge in the world, or the most crazy user on the internet? Because if you want to ask which system is worse, fine. Let's talk about the worst possible person who could be judging you in each system. And the fact of the matter is, one of the things that I find really weird about anarcho-capitalism is that it seems to exist in this weird universe where the internet vanishes the instant the anarchist state comes along, despite the fact that the internet is the most anarchist space in the country, in the world, really. And the great thing about the internet, though, is that we can log off and we can get reprisal if someone does something in real life to damage us. I was at the Gamergate in DC event a couple weeks back and there was a bomb threat. The police came. That was good. The problem for anarcho-capitalists is that in order for their world to work, the non-aggression principle has to be enforced through social shaming, through all sorts of social means that are indirect but still powerful. But if you give that power to society, what's to stop it from being used to enforce all sorts of other principles? Like, never punch down, never say anything bad about a minority group, or even a majority group if they happen to be historically oppressed. What is to stop Tumblr and that type of person from organizing to add all sorts of principles to your hypothetical anarchist quote-unquote constitution that everybody's indoctrinated with? Because if you want to know who's been more successful at indoctrinating people with their principles over time, here's a hint. It has not been the anarcho-capitalists. The only bulwark against outright mob rule that has worked in history is the usage of the state to protect the individual's private property. Because the individual, unless they have enough money to buy a nuke, is not going to be able to do it as effectively as they'd like. And even if they can buy a nuke, they might blow themselves up. The only way this can work is if you have one person who enforces rules that may not be popular, but that they have the army to enforce and that people have been raised to believe in. And if you have massive amounts of competing armies, you get Westeros, or you get Tumblr versus 4chan, except you can never log off. And that is the world that anarcho-capitalists want to live in. A world where if it's Weave versus Shanley Kane, and you've got the social justice warriors versus the neo-Nazi army fighting each other endlessly, it's not just on your stupid message board, it's in real life with real guns, and you can never log off. Sorry, no thanks.
Brilliant, brilliant, Mithias, you are the man, dude. Like, what a brilliant, brilliant viewpoint. I'm so honored to have you as a contributor to Libertarian Republic. I cherish your brain. and I'm sure that my readers do too. I hope that they will go to libertarianpublic.com every single day and get your viewpoints. Don't forget to check out our podcast on iTunes. Leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy the show. And if you don't have an Apple device, you can also find us on Stitcher. Go to Stitcher.com. That's the Android device that you can download. Get the Freedom Report. And don't forget to come back every single day to your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at thelibertarianrepublic.com.